You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at wearelibertarians.com. Welcome to We Are Libertarians, where our goal is to help you sound smarter while talking to your friends. My name is Chris Spangle. We examine current events from a libertarian perspective while treating modern politics with all of the irreverence it deserves. We toss out the screaming heads and put people before political parties and give context to the news. This is a special series on We Are Libertarians called The Swamp Explained, and I am joined by my friend Rob Quartel, a 45-year fly on the wall in Washington, D.C. Rob has worked for Republican presidential campaigns, government agencies like the EPA, and has been confirmed by the Senate to the U.S. Federal Maritime Commission. He's also been a candidate for Congress and Senate, and given his experience and iconoclastic viewpoints, Rob gives us an insight into the swamp that makes up our nation's capital, adding in a little music this time, just a little production elements. So it is so good to have my friend Rob here. Rob, how are you doing today?
Oh, I am doing fine. We're having a lot of amusing times these days, aren't we?
Oh, it's never a dull moment. You know, so one of the things about an election year and why we've been literally behind the scenes prepping for 2 years for this year, you know, our downloads go from, it went from 2,000 to 10,000, like a single year, an episode, because people get so curious. It's like they wake up. It's like spring hits every presidential election. People start waking up to politics. So it's very interesting what, you know, are you getting a lot more people going, hey, who's this guy? How's this working? What do you think about this?
I'm getting a lot more eye rolling.
Really?
You know, I of course, I'm around both Republicans and Democrats and disgusted Republicans and all of that. And just like they say on TV, there are an awful lot of people who are who would love to find a reason to vote against Trump. But they're wary of Bernie. And so it's kind of interesting. It's a great time.
I think,
of course, I've been on the other side of this so many times, you know,
so. Not having anybody to vote for.
Yeah. Well, and you know, one of the big topics, of course, you know, after the debate, which we should talk about too, was the idea of a brokered convention. So, you know, way back when, in 1976, I was with Ford, and we did not have the votes going in. Remember, that was Reagan was very close, and we did not know that whether the president would come out of it with the nomination or not. And we were, boy, we were fighting for every single delegate. I was preparing individual briefing books on every single delegate who was undecided or supposedly undecided. We, of course, had several chairmen. I think Clark Reed was really the pivotal guy down in Mississippi or Missouri. I can't remember which one. One of the M's in the South. And Clark controlled quite a delegation then that could have put us over. And the fact that we were able to get him at the last minute, that's how Ford won. But I'll tell you, it was nip and tuck and holding your breath all the way. There were it's kind of Faustian bargains. Reagan announced he was going to have Schweiker, who was then considered a somewhat liberal senator from Pennsylvania, as his VP candidate before the convention. That was a tactical maneuver on his part.
And let me pause. So just to introduce for the younger folk, Ronald Reagan actually ran for president in 1976 against sitting president Gerald Ford for the nomination. We actually just did an interview with Dan Mitchell, who was a former Cato scholar, who was the issues guy for the Reagan campaign. So I asked him if he had heard of you, and he said, it doesn't ring a bell. But so it's like yesterday and today, it's dueling campaigns from the 76 campaign. So
dueling memories. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
How close?
I was running the issue side from the Ford campaign.
And
it was really not a lot of contact, you know, at all. It was really enemy camps. So
right.
I'm not surprised. And when, even when Reagan did get the nomination in 1980, I could not bring myself to walk across and join the campaign.
But
I came to decide that he was actually pretty good and the right guy at the right time for a number of reasons that we can talk about some other time.
Yeah, let's flesh this out a little bit, because that's an interesting perspective that not a lot of people will, I'm sure, get, because I mean, I'm 36. I don't think I've ever seen a contested convention in my lifetime. Not that I can think of. And I've been a pretty active watcher since the 92 campaign, maybe even the 88 campaign a little bit. But why did Reagan decide to run in 76? And how brutal was that? And what does a contested convention look like after a long primary?
Well, Reagan had actually been thinking about running since 68 against Nixon. And in 72, he kind of made a little noise. And so he just saw 76 as his opportunity. And Gerry Ford is an accidental president. And so it wasn't necessarily bad timing on his part. But I think he became president because he did not get the nomination. I think if he had, I think he would have lost without doubt to Jimmy Carter in 76 because of, you know, Carter sort of represented change. And so in historically, he was lucky to have lost that. But it was a fight. I mean, it was bare knuckles. Every single delegate was scrapped for the promises made. Ford basically tossed Nelson Rockefeller over the cliff and for Dole. And although Dole was nominated at convention.
In what way? So was Dole running or what was the...
No, Dole wasn't running. Basically what happened was, you know, you had Reagan from the right saying that Ford was too moderate, too liberal, too moderate. And of course, Nelson Rockefeller represented the Northeastern Republicans, quote, liberal. And so Ford dumped Nelson, who'd only been his VP for about a year and a half, 2 years maybe, and went in the convention sort of free to make a deal on that. And then, you know, Bob Dole was senator from Kansas and a war hero and from World War II. So he was sort of a natural, although later on in the campaign, once Ford had won the nomination against Carter, of course, Dole was then blamed partly for the downfall of the campaign in one of his debates. Well, there were a number of incidents. I mean, he really wasn't responsible for any of that, but the campaign would get momentum and then something would happen and kind of stop, and then get momentum and something would happen and kind of stop. And for example, his Secretary of Agriculture, Earl Butz, made some kind of foot and mouth remark and had to resign in the middle of it. That stopped us dead in our tracks. Ford himself made a remark in the last debate. He was asked about the so-called captive nations. It's a series of small countries which are now independent on the western side, western and southwestern side of Russia. All of those countries, Lithuania, etc. And the official U.S. position was that they were not really captive and nor part of, they were captive, but they were not part of Russia. And he was asked a question about whether these countries were free or should be free or something. And he totally muffed the answer. He gave the official U.S. position, which sounded pretty crappy to most of the public. And then Dole and his his debate basically talked about Democrat wars with a big D Democrat party. And, you know, we Republicans have long referred to the Democratic Party as the Democrat Party. So not as to give them any advantage, I guess, psychologically as being Democratic. And so and that was a major blow. You know, everybody jumped on it immediately that the wars had been bipartisan and so on and so forth. So, but it was quite a fight. And I think the Democrats are in for their own fight. You know, that it's only what 5% maybe 5% of the delegates.
Let me go back and let me kind of tease that out before we go to that, because you just hit on something that is constantly playing out, and I think people think, oh, this is a brand new development in politics, but Reagan is governor of California, or has just left the governorship of California, and was right. A very conservative person, and the idea that was Gerald Ford a moderate? I mean, was Ronald Reagan super conservative? I mean, or was that just a convenient distinction that he could make, you know, saying, oh, he's too weak, because that idea of strong versus weak seems to continually play into politics. You know, a Bloomberg saying Bernie's too weak to run. He's too far left. I'm the moderate choice. I mean, that idea seems to continually pop up in every single election cycle.
Well, I think it's particularly popped up in the last Democratic one. So Trump won, despite everybody looking at him saying he couldn't win, and in part because of the whole change issue. And then I think Obama won because of the change issue. And Bill Clinton won because he was new and fresh. Jimmy Carter won because he was new and fresh. So I think if you look around at you look at contemporaneous events, and you're looking at two things. One, what are most voters turned off by rather than what they're turned on by? And then secondly, what are they motivated by? And those are not necessarily the same thing. So it's not always completely predictable, but you've got a situation where we've just gone through months, a year, 2 years of the Democrats hammering on Trump on impeachment and everything else, and losing on the Mueller report, and losing on impeachment, in my opinion, basically strengthening Trump.
Remember impeachment? Remember when that happened? It seemed so long ago that impeachment took place.
Well, and I have to say, Nancy Pelosi has probably put the hammer down on those guys, because you remember that immediately after, everyone was talking about what are the next hearings, and you had Schiff and everybody else threatening to do it. And where has that gone? Just has disappeared.
Well, you look at some of the Stone and the Bill Barr stuff, and you see the Democrats salivating for another round of impeachment, and you're just like, guys, what are you doing?
Yeah, but I think Pelosi's a shrewd operator. I think she knows there's not a lot of percentage in it. And I'd say that Barr has maneuvered himself around on that issue too. So, but I would not be surprised if they go into brokered convention. But the twist on this, this is kind of links to the Russian interference, which is that essentially what the Russian MO last time was to whip up a frenzy in social media around the notion that somehow the establishment was going to take it away from Trump and give it to Hillary. And so that was a play on both sides. And they whipped up anti-Hillary stuff with the Sanders people by, again, it was the establishment has taken this away from you, and then they lost Trump. And so, if anything, I have to believe that what the Russian interference right now on Sanders is doing is starting to whip up the establishment's going to take it away from you again. You're going to go to a brokered convention. You're going to have the most delegates. And then they're going to get these super delegates, 700 people, and steal it from you again. And of course, at the same time, they want to whip Sanders up as the candidate, either as the direct candidate, which I'm beginning to believe could be a mistake for Trump, and or for his people to stay home again or to vote for Trump like many of them did last time. So. And by the way, watching the debate performance of both Sanders and Warren, I think their energy could conceivably overcome the disability of their positions on a lot of issues among people who want to take on Trump. So I'm not sure that they would necessarily lose if they had the nomination.
Yeah. So there's a lot to unpack there. Let's start with the Russia stuff, because.
Yeah.
In my mind, the media and select Democrats way overplay the Russia hand to the point that it becomes a joke. Someone sent me a Bernie bro on my Facebook had posted several screenshots of John Kennedy gets elected due to Russian interference. Jimmy Carter sold out to the Russians. Barack Obama is the favorite president of Putin. Like it's a perennial line, and the idea that Donald Trump, I mean, as a person who works on Facebook for a living and is a social media marketer, I can tell you that $100,000 in ad spends on Facebook is not going to tip the election in any direction. It barely can get you any downloads for your podcast. It's a minimal amount. Are the Russians trying to interfere in our elections? Absolutely. They're trying to do what we do to them. But the leaking of an anonymous intelligence official, you know, saying, oh, Trump's it seems like a pretense again for if Donald Trump wins re-election, he only won the election because the Russians helped him and not because Hillary didn't campaign in three swing states or because the Democrats nominated Bernie. It seems like the Russians and tech companies have become the scapegoats for why the candidates that the elites hate get elected, as opposed
I think that's right.
The reality is that they're making mistakes.
None of the intelligence agencies or Mueller said that the Russian effort actually carried anyone over the line. And in fact, they said you couldn't tell, but they didn't, you know, basically they didn't believe it. And I suspect that's true. But, you know, Trump is still smarting from losing the popular vote, and he is a conspiracy theorist. So it's easy for him to both mock and support conspiracy theories at the same time. So he's correct that the left and the Hillary people have just not given up. Like a dog with a bone, they are not giving up. He can't possibly have been legitimately elected. And you know, he won. And so they want to believe there's something there. I think we all know that the Russian effort, and it's not just Russians, it's others, is real. You know, we've seen the Saudis engaged in it, and we know East Europeans. And in fact, the Ukraine was involved at some level too. So, and social media is very powerful. I think it's most powerful in ticking people off enough to engage continuously. I have this running Twitter battle on the Jones Act, my favorite topic, you know,
right?
Sort of have re-engaged in that. And oh my God, I can put something out and all the bad boys all come back at you. And of course I want to sit there and tweet back at them, which I will do sometimes, you know, back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And you think, oh, I got to go eat lunch. That's the only thing that stops it. So, and there's an awful lot of research, as you well know, MIT and Stanford and Harvard and all these other places, and technology and Carnegie Mellon and on and on and on. It does have an influence, and it is viral, and that's the problem. And it has probably some modest influence on turnout, but in the end, no one believes they actually did it last time. Are they more sophisticated this time? Who knows? And by the way, I think the public tends to think of it not so much in social media terms, but are they somehow infecting the machinery of the election? I think, honestly, I'm much more worried about the machinery of the election being hacked than anything else.
Yeah, meaning going into the online machines. Yeah.
Well, just look how screwed up the Iowa caucuses were, and the fact that in Nevada they had to basically ditch their app they were going to use and come up with something else, and still took them too much time to come up with.
Let's touch on
results.
That because you and I've built an app, and I paid a lot more for my app for a radio show than the Iowa people did. Like, you work in technology too. Mm-hmm. Like, when you heard that they spent $63,000, I mean, this is why you cannot have online elections, because the nature of government is they give the contract to the best politically connected, not necessarily the best designers, and they built this app for $63,000 with brand new coders. What else did they expect to happen? It just was laughable. I mean, from a technology perspective, did you just cringe when you started to read the details of that?
And of course, I don't know how much testing they did. It's really hard to test on the battlefield in the middle of the battle. As to whether something works, but you know, you can screw up royally on not just small things like that, but on big ones. Remember that if you go back to Romney versus Obama, Romney had this massive data room operation inside a stadium or some massive physical facility in, I think it was Boston, that was supposed to be monitoring state by state, precinct by precinct, captain by captain, really goose people to try to move voters out and make sure they got to the polls and everything else. And it totally blew up in their face. And that was millions of dollars. So I think the things like this, which are complex systems, require a lot more effort than we think. They're not simple yes or no kinds of things. They're complex, very organic, constantly evolving systems. And there are so many exogenous factors that affect what's going on. You just can't always control for it. So you would think you could, but you can't.
That may be the biggest word ever used on We Are Libertarians. What was that? Like exogenous?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
That means things outside of your zone that you can't control that come at you. Like the weather is an exogenous factor for a farmer.
I love it.
He can anticipate it. He can prepare for it. He can remedy the effects of it, but he can't stop that rain cloud.
So
not yet.
So let's look at the candidates, the Democratic candidates. It is interesting to me that in 2020 we may have an election where an independent senator has the Democratic nomination, or a person who was a Republican 5 minutes ago turned Democrat could be the nominee for the Democrats. And Donald Trump, who was until about 3 years ago a Democrat, now turned Republican as the Republican nominee. And Lord help me, if the Libertarian Party screws this up and nominates some idiot, I will never promote the Libertarian Party again, because this is shaping up to be
who's on the lead there.
I don't even want to get into it, because they're all so insane and they're jokes. It's not even worth your time talking about the people that are running for president for the Libertarians. I'm really hoping Lincoln.
Well, maybe we have you run.
Maybe I could do better than any of these jokers. I'm hoping Justin Amash gets in. It's possible, but we'll see.
The next couple of weeks are going to really be something.
Yeah, it's just, you know, the realities of needing a multi-party system in the United States is, it seems like it's fast approaching. Like I've always said, political parties are empty vessels. You fill it with whatever you want, and we're seeing that result now. But the parties may put up candidates in the fall that don't necessarily represent the majority of the United States and their beliefs. I mean, how did we get to this point?
Well, so I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I think it's entirely predictable yet. I don't think there's enough data. Number one, I think Bernie has been winning partly on the young vote and his earlier followers. Whether that would translate into whether he can translate momentum into something bigger than a narrow set of demographics, that's going to be a key question. And whether he goes all the way, you know, like, you know, in the next week we have South Carolina, which is maybe 50-ish, 54 delegates. And so Joe Biden is staking his all on that. Well, so Bernie won by, what was it this morning? It was 41%, and Biden was 19, and Buttigieg was 15, and I believe Warren was 14, and Klobuchar, who I think is actually pretty good, was trailing behind that. And of course, Bloomberg wasn't even on the ballot. But now we have South Carolina. And one of the things the commentators were saying today is, well, 20 points is a major lead, and Biden's going to need 20 points in South Carolina. Well, I'm going to be stunned if he gets 20 points in South Carolina, except that I don't think Buttigieg has much of a following down there, although apparently he's spending a lot of money. And Amy Klobuchar, I don't think, has a lot of following down there. So I think in South Carolina, it's going to be Biden, Sanders, probably Buttigieg will be making a strong play. I know Warren is still going to be hammering on that one. I think Steyer has put some money in it. And of course, I don't think Bloomberg's on that ballot either.
I don't think he's been on a ballot yet. I think he's really,
but he is on Super Tuesday.
Yeah.
And a third of the delegates are going to be chosen on March 3rd. And that It's just, that's a massive, massive undertaking. So I think I saw that he had spent $140 million or something on Super Tuesday, and the next closest was might have been Steyer at 30, and then the rest of them spent probably $5 million. Well, I think Biden was a couple $3 million or something, and the rest of them combined are not $3 million. So
yeah, that's,
that ranges from Alabama to, you know, California with like 50, and California with the 400 and some, and Massachusetts to Minnesota, North Carolina, Tennessee. I mean, it's massive, massive distribution geographically. So that's where the power of advertising will be tested. I mean, Virginia's in that too. And I can already tell you that that there, I run into more people who are moving their way over to Bloomberg in Virginia among Democrats and independent Republicans than anyone else. So
why are they moving to him? What's the appeal?
I think it's maybe it's an irrational search for someone who makes sense. I don't know. You know, it's I just think the reality is that Bernie is scary, and Elizabeth Warren is not enough warm and fuzzy. I think she's sort of lost her mojo, and I think Biden is feeling more and more tired, and I've long thought it was probably Biden-Klobuchar is the only ticket that could beat Trump. But conceivably, Bloomberg could. You know, Bloomberg, I know people in his operation, and they are no doubt the most sophisticated people in this game. They really understand, and it is entirely digitally driven. I will say they were, in my opinion, overconfident going into the debate. You know, my understanding is that they have been practicing debating for weeks, if not months, and thought they had every issue fleshed out. And the evening has started out, and it was pretty clear he didn't have any sea legs.
He performed poorly. I mean, Donald Trump.
Although the most honest remark was when he said, you know, the main thing I'm thinking is that this is the most ridiculous scene I've ever seen, and it's only going to help elect Donald Trump.
Yeah, what a great country. I thought the first hour he was just abysmal and didn't have any defense for himself. But then once they got into capitalism versus socialism, I felt he really exposed Bernie as sort of a weird looking kook, and he got under Bernie's skin. Bernie was very prickly and seemed agitated, and I think Bernie Sanders, that was the only debate that I've watched in full so far, and Sanders seemed like he was the worst in terms of being able to fight back because he took it all too personally, and he would do terribly in a debate with Donald Trump, where everybody else kind of had some fight to them.
Actually, you know? I came away thinking I had really a very different takeaway from all that. I really felt like he really stood up for himself. And, you know, he is very constant. He hammers on the same points every single time. He ignores what he doesn't want to do. That's perfect as a politician. He has passion. I actually came away thinking he was potentially a better candidate against Trump on a debate. Now that doesn't translate necessarily into on the votes, you know, on the road when people have a few minutes to reflect on it and whether there's some kind of interesting alternative third party. But it was without a doubt the best debate I've ever seen in 45 years.
Really?
And I know Peggy Noonan wrote a great column about it, saying essentially the same thing in the Wall Street Journal yesterday. And, you know, it was a different format. So they were allowed to take on each other directly, which I think is a really good thing, except it kind of blew up in Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg's face there when they almost got, you know, the fisticuffs. And you have Biden standing there thinking, whoa, what's going on here? And he had a few good moments. You know, he kind of came across as the elder statesman, but he doesn't.
When Amy forgot the name of the Mexican politician, he's like, I'm the only one up here that has met the guy. Like, I thought that was a good moment for him. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Except it got passed over by the fight, you know. And I think Pete is he's very interesting. I think he's not quite ready to be president. Whatever you think about all the other stuff, he's just issue-wise, he's just a little too callow.
He's smarmy. He's the try-hard kid who in your high school was running for student council president and said all the right things, but was just smarmy.
Yeah. Well, and Amy Klobuchar may have gone just a little too far when saying, "You're so perfect, Pete." That was just a little too much personal peak. Where Bloomberg failed, though, where he failed was in telling his own story, which is he tells incredibly well in the ads, and the ads are incredibly well tested, I assure you. But in the ads, you know, it's a guy who had nothing as a kid. He went to college. He got fired from his day job. He came up with a brilliant idea. He turned it into a massive company. And, you know, and Bernie managed to turn that around. Well, maybe you should get, or Elizabeth, maybe you should, Bernie did, maybe you should give some credit to your workers. Well, he didn't have a lot of workers initially because it was, you know, it was basically a digital solution. And with, you know, they put the computer screens in everybody's office, and he, Mike Bloomberg, went around doing the selling. And what he should have said in that whole thing, when Bernie said, should billionaires exist? And he said, yes. And that kind of was a great one word, one liner, for a lot of people in the audience, but he could also have followed that up appropriately with, you know, I've worked my entire life. I had nothing. I inherited nothing, unlike Donald Trump. I made my money by hard work and a great idea. And yes, there were a lot of people who worked with me on it. And we together built a big company, and I deserve every penny I took home. And now I'm giving every penny of it away. That's what he should have said. So, and he did the same sort of thing, you know, that Trump did on the tax returns, only not so well. And I know he'll get him out in a couple weeks. If I were he, I'd do everything I can, and I suspect they show up much better than Trump's.
Mm-hmm. So I thought that it was interesting that capitalism got a tepid applause at a Democratic Party debate. Yeah. I mean, has that happened in kind of your watching politics over the year? I mean, where it seems to me that seems like a fundamental thing that Americans were capitalists. We love capitalism. And it was nice to see Bloomberg actually declare that. But it got a tepid applause because Bernie has moved the party so much more towards his side of the things.
I think people like what capitalism has brought them and the freedom you have inside this system to invent companies and do this and that. But I think generationally, as people on both ends, both many of the older generation, many of my peers, and many in the much younger generation, you know, you, my kids younger, see a lot of the kind of disabilities of the system.
Right.
Where people do get left behind, and we all see the tremendous wealth, and why can't we do this instead of doing that? And the people, so I think the word capitalism, it kind of has a little bit of a jarring effect. And that's where Bernie calling it democratic socialism is I think he's correct in the way he's positioning it because it's democratic and it's socialism in the sense of it feels, you know, more social to a lot of people. I don't think they even know what it means. I think Bloomberg calling it communism was just the beginning of what that's going to show up to be. But I think there's also a foil in Denmark. They all refer to Denmark. And someone in there has to say, Denmark is a tiny little country, less than the size of New York City, and it's entirely homogeneous. And they now are facing their own set of issues with Turkish immigrants and all of these other folks from the Middle East coming across, and they're facing tremendous issues around violence that they have never experienced before. And so it's not all perfect, but it's a lot easier when everybody looks like everybody else.
Well, it's the same with healthcare. You know, saying that why could Canada have healthcare? Canada has 33 million people and we have 370 million people. And
that's right.
You know, working in the tech industry, you understand the concept of scale.
Yeah.
The bigger you scale something, the more complex the problems become. And you look at socialism in Russia through the USSR, it's almost hack to say that, but that was a major land spread, lots of different cultures, all trying to be governed by a central planning committee, and it just didn't work, and it won't work here, and you can't have a healthcare system with 370 in the same way you can at 330 million people. It just doesn't work, and it's foolish.
And what has made this country succeed is the fact that we have distributed systems. So we have widely distributed government systems, you know, state, federal, and local. The fact that we have 50 states and however many territories and all the rest actually is the one thing that allows this country to actually function across the geographies. You know, I think I referred several times to Jill Lepore's history book, one volume history of the U.S. And one of the interesting things she talks about is early in the early days of the Republic, it was growing so fast that people were afraid that they would lose touch with from the east to the west, and we would eventually have to break up. The first non-political newspaper was in the 1820s. Before that, all the papers were like the British papers, which were all essentially partisan organs, party organs. And then people thought that would help bring people together, but it wasn't enough. And then you have Samuel Morse and in the 1830s and the stringing across to the other side of the continent in the 1840s, people thought that would bring us all together because we all had the same information at the same time, which it didn't necessarily. And then radio, similar effect, and TV, where we had ABC, CBS, and NBC all under the equal time doctrine and the fair, you know, where they had to present both sides. So we were all essentially getting a lot of the same news. And then, boom, you got cable explosion and 1,000 channels and with a lot of different voices. And it's good from one standpoint, which is as a consumer, you can pick what you want. But it's bad because as a consumer, you can pick what you want to hear,
right,
and what you want to believe. And so you have these forces back and forth and back and forth all across time. And I think that's what you're seeing in the party conflicts today and the voter and the electorate. But, you know, there's still a threat. And that was back to this issue of 300 and some million people, 370 million people being different. And we are different. We are much more heterogeneous than any other country on the planet, except maybe the Russians used to be when they were the Soviet Union. And now there's probably no one as heterogeneous as we are.
Yeah. So I think it's kind of safe to say at this point, just going through the candidates and people who are probably going to survive the next month, it's probably going to be Bernie, Bloomberg, and maybe Biden, although Biden seems like he's kind of on his last legs. You know, Mayor Pete never really gets above 15%. Amy and Elizabeth Warren are kind of they're there, but they're splitting the vote a little bit. And, you know, so let's focus on Bernie, Bloomberg, and let's say Biden.
Yeah, and I think Steyer has just got to drop out. That's ridiculous.
Yeah. So, well, part of what Bloomberg is doing and part of why I say that is Bloomberg is waging a war of attrition. So he is forcing these candidates to spend money in places that they weren't ready to spend money, places like California or Florida or other places or Texas. You know, Bernie's in Texas today, and it's because Bloomberg is spending so much damn money that, you know, Bernie is having to spend money, and it's going to burn through those smaller campaigns so much quicker. And their name ID is the most important, in my opinion, the most important factor in an election.
Well, that was my point earlier about Bernie and about Bloomberg and the money. You go into this Super Tuesday, it's really literally going to be about advertising. I will say that Biden has his whole operation on the line next week in South Carolina, since he's been saying he's going to win big there. So he sort of has to. And if he doesn't, I think he's out too.
Yeah, so it's Bernie and Bloomberg. I mean, let's go back to the brokered convention. Do you think Bernie can just run away with this thing, or do you think Bloomberg can, you know, and Biden, I heard an interesting take on Jake Tapper today where Rick Santorum basically said something I hadn't thought of, like, Biden saying, I can win in southern states, but if you're in an electoral college fight, who cares if you can win in Alabama? Trump's going to carry that. Like, well, we need you to win in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Bernie can make the claim that he can do that the best, or Bloomberg can. So I just don't think that Biden, his whole appeal was that he was
the most
electable.
Well, that's where I think, though, I do think the election is going to be won up there in the Midwest, the general, and that's where I think their best ticket is probably Biden and Klobuchar.
Yeah.
And I do think she did hit the mayor on Mayor Pete on several of his vulnerabilities. One is he was the mayor of a teeny weeny little town and all of that. So, and he's a little callow. So
of Bernie,
smart, really smart and well informed.
Yeah, I've been impressed with her. So Bernie and Bloomberg.
Yeah.
Who can beat Trump? Can either of them beat Trump?
Good question. I think, depending on how, I think Bloomberg could put together much more easily a ticket and a campaign that could beat Trump than Bernie can. If Bernie gets the nomination, the question is, and he might do what Reagan did, which is pick somebody in advance. That would be what he would have to do for VP, who would signal to the party that he was willing to at least tip his hat to the middle. So that, again, would be Amy Klobuchar or Elizabeth Warren. Well, he wouldn't do Warren. You know, she would just reinforce the socialism thing. He wouldn't do Biden. Who knows? Maybe he'd pick Bloomberg. But it would depend entirely on his tactics at the election as to whether he even had a shot. But I will say, I thought he and Elizabeth Warren were terrific in the debate, notwithstanding that I'd sat there saying, well, hit her back with this or hit him back with that, you know, and what a stupid argument. But it was so, both were heartfelt, strong emotional appeals. And simple messages, which is what you want in a debate. I will say Warren exhibited, whether it's true or not, a lot of nimbleness in the way she attacked Bloomberg. And I know all of that was prepared. You can't believe that anything wasn't pre-tested before any of them went into the debate, which is why it is so his performance was so pathetic in that respect. His history, and you know, they've done I saw last week there was a professor from somewhere who had gone back to look at all of Bloomberg's debate tapes, and he says he's most passionate when he's talking about the American dream and this and that, and when he can talk about himself having done this and done that and done this, but he is essentially dispassionate, and that works against him in a debate like this. And he's a logical, intelligent guy, but I'm sure there's a lot of running around right now trying to figure out how to play the parts of all of the other people in the debate. And, you know, I've said before, I played the part of George Bush Senior in the run-ups to preparing him for his debates. And what we did was we put together a Bob Dole and a, you know, and all of the other candidates, someone knew their records and looked at and watched them for style. And then I had to be George Bush so they could practice against me. And this would have been what year was that? 1987. And, in fact, it was so realistic that I was asked a question at some point, and what would you do about this or that energy policy? And I gave some answer, and everybody in the group, playing Dole and you know, Governor, what's his name from Texas, say he can't possibly say that. he would never say that. Well, the next day, of course, was the actual practice with George H.W. Bush. And the question came up, and he said exactly what I said, which I knew he would, because I had written his papers and I studied his words and I turned them into speeches. And
let me ask a clarifying question. Yeah. So in these debate practices, so you guys have a debate practice for the stand-ins and then you do the debate with the candidate?
Well, that was certainly the way we did it, and I'm sure it was done the rest of the time in other Republican preparation. I don't know if the Democrats do it that way or not. I do think that requires a lot of resources to be able to do that, personnel resources. I'd be surprised that Bloomberg's doing that, but he should be.
So I have never really seen debate performances. Everybody's, you know, on the talking head shows this morning going, oh, that was such a bad debate performance. He's over. I don't think that it matters. I mean, Donald Trump had one of the worst debate performances in history in that first debate, and he still won the presidency. So I don't necessarily know that the Bloomberg debacle the other night is necessarily going to hurt him, not with regular people who probably didn't even watch the debate.
No, I think that's right. I think you're among only a handful of people that I know personally who actually watched it.
Right.
My wife watched like 5 minutes and went to bed.
All these are like 9 p.m. and I get invited on another libertarian podcast for their debate recap, and it's always at 11 p.m. and I'm like, I get up at 5:30. I can't do that.
Yeah, sorry guys. So do I. Well, you know, but again, the reason it is important, it's because of the intermediary interpreters, meaning the talking heads, and the next morning the newspapers and all of that. Although, you know, I noted this morning in the Times and the Post that I don't think there's a whole lot about Bloomberg and his debate performance 5 days ago. Now it's now on to Biden and how the other people have to concentrate on Bernie and stop attacking Bloomberg. And frankly, for their own good, that's what they should do, because I do think, like you, it's likely to come down to Bloomberg and Bernie, unless Biden can pull it out this week. And you and I should be talking in about 2 weeks about what's coming up. It's going to be a lot of water over this dam.
I think nobody that I have seen is talking about, because the media just won't, they won't say this out loud, how good the Trump campaign is and will be, and how much they've learned over the last 4 years. It was a, you know, slipshod operation in 2016, and they squeaked by on accident, breaking every fundamental. But I think because they broke every fundamental principle of political science, is led to a campaign now that embraces that as their doctrine. And I don't know that Democrats are giving consideration to the fact that Bernie Sanders had his own TV show in the 70s and 80s and went to Russia. Yeah. And there is an enormous amount of tape on this guy because he was an OG podcaster back in the day. Like, I could never run for president because of dumb things I may have said in 2012 or 2013. It's out there and it exists. And Brad Pascal and the Donald Trump campaign are not going to be afraid to pull every stop out, put up an Instagram ad of Bernie Sanders in Russia or talking about Cuban. I don't think that anybody in the media is talking about how good the campaign will be in terms of destroying the credibility of Bernie Sanders and Michael Bloomberg because of the amount of stuff that's out there. And that is one factor. Now, Trump is always the person who takes two steps forward and three steps backward because he screws himself up.
Yeah.
But I think that the Democrats are just they're going into this like 2016. He can't possibly win. We just need to nominate anybody. Howard Dean's like, "Oh, this is in the bag this morning." And I'm like, "You guys are idiots." This their campaign is brutal and they're going to fight nasty, and Bernie Sanders is the worst one that you guys could put up.
But I will say they can come together. There's plenty of time. A lot can happen in a single day in a presidential campaign.
Yeah.
And so the reality is they, as brutal as it is now, it doesn't mean they can't win, you know, and it's happened before. So it's not like it's the first time it would ever happen.
Right.
Yeah. So there are a lot of things happening this week. Obviously, you know, Barr, Trump's going to India this week. He's promising. He said Modi has promised him 10 million people for an audience, and the stadium holds 175,000. Isn't completed, but he'll probably get a bunch on the streets. And of course, the interesting thing about that is that we don't exactly have a good relationship with India right now. So it's no trade agreement. We slapped massive tariffs on them. So it'd be interesting to see how that all plays out. And let's
go back to the Barr thing. Yeah, because I want to ask you, I have not totally followed the Roger Stone, Bill Barr, Donald Trump stuff. I know that they sentenced Roger Stone. They didn't run it up the flagpole to the Justice Department, and Barr or Trump or somebody felt that Roger Stone was oversentenced and was reduced from 7 to 3 years. What exactly happened, and why is this a controversy?
So if you get past all the histrionics, Trump tweeted that, what happened was somehow it leaked out that the prosecutors were going to recommend 7 to 9 years, the local guys. And then the next thing you know, you have a tweet, and then the next thing you have is the prosecutor's recommendation is overridden by the Justice Department at the top, which is too much for what he did and inconsistent. And then Barr says that he had already decided that. And there are an awful lot of people in the legal profession who would agree with him that that was overreaching. And who knows, it might have been overturned by the judge. My understanding is that procedurally, the local guys are supposed to run that up the flagpole of the department. And that's not just symbolic. The department has to decide whether that's what they want to go for. And in the end, he got, I think, 2.5 years. He's got time to put everything in order. And I suspect he's going to stay out for a while. I think they'll probably grant him a retrial. So we'll see on that. But it looks bad. And that's where Barr made the remark that Trump makes his job impossible by his tweets, because in the absence of that, Barr would have reduced the recommendation, overridden the prosecutors, and then there wouldn't have been a whole lot of flap about it. It would have been some, but not quite as much.
It was the fact that the head of the Justice Department, Donald Trump, basically would look like he was interfering in what is supposed to be an independent prosecution.
And then Trump went out and said he was a chief law enforcement officer of the United States. So in a lot of ways, he is. It's not his job, but his job is to see that the laws of the land are faithfully executed. You know, if you look at the oath. So it's not that he is the literal chief law enforcement officer, but he's the chief person in charge of seeing the laws enforced. So he's rhetorically close, but it's the kind of stuff that would make Barr's life difficult. And I don't know if I think Barr will stay. I think he probably will. I think they've got an understanding, I suspect.
Yeah, the you know, Dennis, who's on our podcast regularly, says, he was just chosen because he's Trump's wingman, like Holder was Obama's wingman, and he was there to defend him from the Mueller investigation. He's not truly independent, which is maybe why he said Trump's tweets are making my job impossible. But you don't see many administration officials be critical of Trump and kind of survive that. So I thought that was interesting.
Well, and then we kind of, the flip side of that is the impact of Trump on his own nominee, his own people, as we have the former attorney general running for the Senate nomination down now in Mississippi. Is that right, Mississippi?
Alabama.
Alabama, Jeff right. Sessions. You know, they all look the same, even though I'm a Southerner. Jeff Sessions. And it'll be interesting to see what happens with that one, too. Or if Trump can keep his nose out of it long enough to let the voters have a say.
Roger Stone is... Usually he throws these people under the bus, but I think because Stone has been so virulent in his defense of Trump at every step and on InfoWars, hosting his own show, talking about how great Donald Trump is, that's why Donald Trump feels the duty to help Stone, who shepherded his other two presidential campaigns or encouraged them. Get Me Roger Stone on Netflix is a great documentary. I've met Stone a couple times. He has a head like a spade shovel. I mean, it's just incredible if you ever see it in person.
And for those who don't know him, he has a full-size tattoo of Richard Nixon on his back. And that was his first major candidate. Now, intelligently, and I think someone had to have gotten to Trump, he said yesterday, I think, asked if he would interfere. He said, no, I think he's going to win his appeal. So we'll just see how it plays out.
So I had vaguely
a much better position to be in.
I'd heard vaguely that like the head juror on the foreman of the jury hated Stone and hated Trump, and that's the grounds that he'll get it overturned. And so I have not dove deep, but if you're interested in any of this, you can look into all that stuff. But now it's time to transition to our favorite part of the program.
Restaurants.
Rob Cortell he loves restaurants as much, probably more than I do. And he is fortunate to live in one of the great food cities in the United States. It's known for its politics, but the food is pretty great in Washington, D.C. And so he likes to give us the diner's guide to D.C. and tell us where's a good place to eat or get a drink or visit if you're going to the nation's capital, which you should because it's an amazing place to visit. So what are your recommendations for our audience
for food,
when they go to D.C.?
Well, before I get to that, I'm going to tell you, I've just put myself on a keto diet.
Oh.
I came back from a week-long trip to California where I had more weight than I've ever had in my entire life, and I decided I had to be radical about this.
Uh-huh.
So I'm not drinking as much as and only eating certain things, but I have three good recommendations. But you'll find quickly the reason for the trip is that the National Science Foundation gives out $50,000 grants to research scientists to help them learn how to bring a good idea to market. And as we all know, good ideas don't always make good companies. So I went with this team from Virginia Tech, which has a technology that matches wine grapes to the right soil and vice versa, huh, and has climatological data on top to project 5, 7, 10 years in the future. Is that grape still going to survive in that climate as the climate changes? And so some people may be climate deniers, but not grape growers, wine growers. So I've spent the last 4 or 5 weeks interviewing a lot of vineyards with them. They have to do 100 customer interviews. But so there have been the three really terrific restaurants that are pretty new. One is the first Burmese restaurant in Washington. It's called Tame, T-H-A-M-E-E. And it's really kind of a combination of Indian and Thai and Chinese flavors and all that. Fantastic. Definitely, you know, a couple stars.
I live, and here's a weird connection. I live in the number two most populated location on Earth for Burmese in Southport, Indiana. That is where most Chin, who are political refugees, have settled here, mm-hmm, or in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And so my local grocery store went from a Marsh grocery, which was like Kroger, to a Vietnamese, Burmese grocery store. It is massive. There are squid and bugs and things that I've never seen in my life. And I'm surrounded by Burmese restaurants. I need to go.
Well, you have to go next time. But we had the most fabulous duck, and the mother of the operation is also, she's Burmese and is a chef as well, and it's run by her son or daughter-in-law or something. But they have another very successful restaurant also in D.C. But this one's great. Second one is called Emily's, and we've been trying to get there for quite a while, and that's very, 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 very good and creative chef, young Asian chef. But the Pièce de Résistance is a new restaurant that has opened in a new little boutique hotel, the Thompson Hotel, across the street from where I'm now living in D.C., where my apartment is, where I am a couple days a month. And Danny Meyer, who is one of the most famous chefs on the planet, and began in Chicago and has fabulous restaurants all around and one in New York, has opened what the name of Maialano Mare, M-A-I-A-L-A-N-O Mare, and it's Italian. And the chef came down from his New York restaurant of the same name. Her name is Rose, and they have a fantastic welcoming staff, and it's a beautiful restaurant. I will say that the food is just impeccable, and you would think it would be incredibly expensive by Washington standards, it's not. And one of the most interesting things is they don't allow tipping. So the tip is built into the price. So of everything from the wine and the drinks and the pasta and the seafood. But so I've been recommending to my friends that that's their special occasion restaurant. But because it's across the street, I now end up eating breakfast there a fair amount.
So. So is the tip, is it just like, hey, where you're paying 20% whether you like it or not? Or is it just like they don't even tell you that you tipped?
Who knows what your actual tip is? You know, I typically just double the bill and 20, it actually ends up at about 22%, unless I'm ticked off. And I try not to eat at restaurants again that I'm ticked off. And I try to distinguish between the waiter or waitress and the food. And so I'm guessing it's probably in the 18 to 20% range, but and they share this all. They share profits with the staff and they seem very happy about it. Although the funny reaction of other restaurants, that the bartenders and the waitresses at other comparable restaurants say, oh, that won't last long. They just don't make so much money. I make so much more money in tips and blah, blah, blah. But I suspect it will last. And Danny Meyer has plenty of creds to do it. But it's a fantastic restaurant, Milano Marais.
Interesting. Okay.
And it's right on, and we're on the water in D.C., in the ballpark area there. So
great. And was there a third, or is that the third?
That's the third.
Okay.
So Emily's.
Okay.
Tame, the Burmese, and Milano Marais.
Excellent. All right, Rob, it's always great to talk to you. This was a great conversation, and we appreciate your time so much. And
next week, I'll come back. Next time, I'll be 20 pounds lighter.
You will. Oh, this keto thing is no joke. Like, I tried to survive it. I lost 10 pounds in the 4 weeks that I did it, but then I was just like, I want a cheeseburger, and I want the bun. I just couldn't do it. All right. Well, thanks so much for joining
me.
All
right.
And I appreciate it.
Couple weeks.
All right, let's talk after Super Tuesday and get some perspective there. All right, thanks for listening to We Are Libertarians, and we will talk to you next.